Well, here, folks, here we go. I very much enjoyed speaking about the Punovitcher Rav and Meir Shapiro. Baruch Hashem. So anyway, I really enjoyed talking about the Punovitcher Rav and Meir Shapiro to all of you. Yeah? For the Maisa, there's a certain problem with people like that. Because in the back of our heads, right, we can't avoid a voice which says to us, like, I can never be like them. I can never look at them, look like them. They're geniuses of a higher caliber. They were built for greatness, right? But you say to yourself, why can't I look like this? This is Mike Truss, Rabosa, okay? We're going to talk about a lay leader, a super lay leader called... Full name was Gabriel Elimelech Truss, but they called him Mike, as the bike's called. They called him Mike. This is the original Mike. That's not that imposter, okay? He's not even a good imposter because he looks black, right? This is the real Mike. This is the real Mike Rabosa. Okay, we're gonna try to appreciate over the next 40 minutes who we're talking about, and I hope we're gonna touch everybody a little bit. Who was he? So he was one of the earliest and most dominant leaders of Agudat Yisrael in America. We spoke about Agudah last time. Which was the organized Orthodoxy. Someone who gave all of himself for the Jewish people, for on the whole and for individuals. Someone whose rescue efforts during the war saved hundreds, if not thousands, from the Nazi inferno. Someone who built a great national organization. He built the Agudat Yisrael, which was a phenomenal organization. He was an unstoppable leader who humbly inspired hundreds of his followers and made other leaders. One of the greatest marks of leaders to make other leaders, to his personal example. Okay, but I always like to say that it touches me a lot. There's maybe no greater tribute than the types of dreams Tzaddikim had about him. So listen to this. Okay, almost everything is from this book. Usually we cull from a few sources. This is the only real source I have. My Jonathan Rosenblum's book. Okay, in the middle of the war, the Kapishnitzer Rebbe had a dream. He saw a Gan Eden. And he was seated at the foot of the table. At the head of the table was a good-looking young American. So he's like in the back of the table. Very chash of a Rebbe, the Kapishnitzer Rebbe. It's hard to say it. Once you get it right, you can say it 20 times. Say Kapishnitzer 10 times fast. Okay. But anyway, so his neighbor turned to him and said, "Hey, why are you at the end of the table? And that fellow without pants or beard is sitting at the head of the table." So the Rebbe turns to him and he says, "You don't know Mike?" That's all you have to say. You don't know Mike. If you knew Mike, you understood why he was at the head of the table and Tzaddikim were at the end of the table. But even a greater dream was by Shraga Feivel Mendelovich, himself a great Torah builder. We have a class about him. Not so well developed. Anyway, so Shraga Feivel Mendelovich was the head of the Torah Vadas Yeshiva. You ever heard of Torah Vadas? He ran the Torah Vadas Yeshiva and he was a tremendous Torah builder himself. So he used to give a Tehillim Shir on Tuesday nights on Bedford Avenue. So anyways, he suddenly stopped. In the middle of the shiur, he said, "I had a dream." Again, he thought Martin Luther King made it up. So you think Mike is Mike Jordan? Martin Luther King had a dream. Not true. Mike is Mike Truss. And the one who had a dream was Shraga Feivel Mendelovich. Okay. In my dreams, listen to this. Mashiach came. Kings, presidents, and prime ministers all came to greet him. But ahead of them were the great Rabbanim. Rabbi Eliezer Silver in his tall stovepipe hat. Rabbi Aaron Cutler with his burning eyes. Rabbi Kalmanovich with his long white beard. And the Mashiach turned to me and asked, "Who's that sitting in the back, not pushing forward? The one without the beard." Mashiach asked, "Who's that?" So I answered, "That's the one who brought you." Rabbi Elimelech Gabriel Truss. That's pretty chashuv. Tzaddikim to dream such things about. So let's learn about him. First, we're going to talk about a little bit what he did. And to get the background, we have to understand a little bit what state orthodoxy was at in America at the time. Right? He was born about 1909. So today, when we think about orthodoxy in America, you're thinking about a strong, big, developed yeshivas, a giant, right? It wasn't great by any stretch of the imagination, as I'll show you. And the organization which probably had the greatest impact in creating a strong orthodoxy was the Agudat Yisrael in America, right? And the Agudat Yisrael clear leader for tens of years was Mike Truss, the one we're talking about. So how what were things like? What world did he grow up into? So when we think about the United States today, a little bit less than 5 years ago, but we still think wealth. Jews are pretty wealthy. The community is pretty wealthy. You have to realize, when Jews came from Europe, they were dirt poor. And we mean dirt poor. No money, right? All the people who became rich came with nothing, by and large, right? And that forced mothers and even children to work, which weakened family ties. Keeping jobs was very difficult, right? What happened when you kept a job? Friday afternoon, the boss said to you, coming back tomorrow. You said, hopefully, no. He said, well, don't come back on Monday, right? Don't come back on Monday. That was it, and that happened. A chiddush to me, when I looked into it, there was a lot of Jewish crime. You don't think of Jews and crime. I mean, a few mobsters, only a few clever crime, right? But there's a lot of Jewish crime. Harper's Magazine in 1908 said that half of New York offenders were Jews. Not nice to say that, right? Can you imagine? In 1906, it said 30% of those arraigned in children's court were Jews, right? And Jews, of course, were flocking to universities, exposed to all types of non-Torah values. My son, the doctor. Judaism was mocked in socialist press and Yiddish press. They used to have Yom Kippur and Tisha B'Av dances. Yom Kippur dances, Tisha B'Av dances, March of Bread on Pesach. The original thing, March of Bread. And, this is very important, just to explain what Mike was doing, other Orthodox forms was like a vague, nostalgic type of thing, you know, more than a religion. The stars of Yiddish theater were Michal Shabbos, and they would be Chazanim. They have here a member of a youth choir remembers getting smacked by the choir leader for actually saying the words during Kedusha. You're not supposed to say the words. And another time, someone else got berated for fasting on Yom Kippur. They told him it was Gezel. If you fast on Yom Kippur, you're not going to sing well in the choir. Could you imagine? Right?
Where is this?
This is the United States of America, Lower East Side. This is it. There's the person from Goldstein, he quotes that he remembers walking home from on Shabbos morning, he'd see his neighbor lit up with a cigarette, and then he would turn to him in Yiddish, the man with the cigarette, was hast du gelernt die Woche? What'd you learn this week? And he would tell him, I'm Baba Kama, and then this fry guy with a cigarette would start rattling off the Gemara Ashitosis. Did you get the situation?
On Shabbos.
The youth were not educated. Listen to this, guys. 1918 survey, there are 275,000 school-aged children in New York City. Only 65,000, that's less than a quarter, about a quarter. Only around 1 in 4 Jewish kids had any form of Jewish education, including like secular Jewish education. It was like nothing. 1 in 4. And an ironic exacerbating factor was that the youth who did come couldn't conduct services. You understand? The shul was still like, oh, kids don't daven. Kids don't get aliyahs. They don't daven. They don't get aliyahs. So on the one hand, it was, now that could be in Europe, which was stronger, you could do such a thing, right? Maybe it's the decorum of the shul. But in America, there's so much that's so interesting to them, and Judaism is so not developed, and the Jewish world is so not developed, but when a kid does go to shul, not for you. It wasn't a user-friendly, the term we would use today, okay? I want to add two statements of the Gedolim about, on a more deeper level, what was going wrong. Rav Moshe Feinstein, you know who that is, was very famous for saying that Shver Tzayin Yid destroyed Yiddishkeit. It's hard to be a Jew, hurt Yiddishkeit better. Rav Moshe said this over all the time. Shver Tzayin Yid, I have a friend who named his son Moshe Simcha because of this point. Moshe after Moshe Feinstein. And Simcha because Moshe always talked about the fact you have to be Sameach. You have to be happy in your Judaism. It means what? Even the person who would keep Shabbos, he's coming home fired and he would tell his kids, Shver Tzayin Yid, it's hard to be a Jew, it's hard to be a Jew, it's hard to be a Jew. So when you tell your kids enough, it's hard to be a Jew, hard to be a Jew, hard to be a Jew, they'll try to do something else, right? And they were talking about the people who were trying. That was their Moshe thing. Another statement I read from a Gadol one time, Simcha Wasserman, Rabbi Chanan's son, said that my son, the doctor, is what created the generation gap. Generation gap, right? Popular term. What creates a generation gap? Well, I can relate to my sons. My sons love me. You're supposed to be your son's best friend. You're supposed to be your kid's best friend. But when I say my son, the doctor, what am I saying? You are a nachas machine. You're there to give me nachas. Right? You know the joke? First Jewish president. I told you the joke about the first Jewish president. First Jewish president gets up, you know, sing the Hatikva and a little Yiddish song, na 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 na. It's all, everybody's proud of him. His mother's sitting there. So his mother turns to the one next to him. He says, "You see that guy standing up giving the inaugural address?" He says, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." He said, "His brother's a doctor." Thank you for that chuckle. Okay. That was funny. Okay, so what did Mike do for the matzah? So that's, you get it? That's the situation that Judaism was at. That is what America, we're not talking about, guys, we're not talking about Kansas City. Guys, we're not talking about Kansas City over here. We're talking about New York. Yeshivas, this was New York.
Was now, 1920, 1930.
Okay, so he himself came from a frum dedicated family, but definitely not rabbinic. And I hold the big mitzvah to say that he was a yosem. He lost his father at a young age, at 6 months old. Orphaned. He didn't know his father. Interesting. And whatever he accomplished even though he didn't know his dad. So people from divorce told him his things like it's no excuse, and it's a consolation for us. Mike Tress. We can all make an eye. And by the way, I don't remember right now, but many, Ravine Cutler didn't have a dad. And many, many leaders, if you look at it, didn't have fathers. And Goyishlis, I think Robert Lee, Lahavdil, great general of the South, was a phenomenal leader. He also, I think, his father died. But many, 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 many leaders lost their children, their parents young. Anyway, so in the early 20s, he got involved in what was called a fledgling organization called Zeire Agudas Yisrael, like the young Agudas Yisrael. And he was the one who built it and led it and was very active. And there was a far more dynamic movement called Young Israel. So why did he choose Agudas Yisrael, not Young Israel? And there was Young Israel, if you guys know, also was looking to try to bridge the gap to Judaism in the modern world. So he was looking for an overarching vision, an all-encompassing philosophy. Young Israel was making Nusach America, if we will, right? But there wasn't like an overall picture. There weren't, Agudas Yisrael was a world organization. Remember we spoke last time, started in Germany and it spread to Poland, etc. And it was uniting the whole, so then Agudas Yisrael, even though it wasn't as popular an organization as Young Israel, but that's what Mike was looking for. Mike was looking for something big, something with be dealing with the whole picture. And Agudas Yisrael was very built on Gedolei Yisrael, which he venerated. And he venerated the Gedolim. He would hear a speech from a Gadol, he would say it over. You know, he wasn't a big, by the way, we should point out, he wasn't a big Talmud Chacham. I don't know if Mike Tress, he was not a big Talmud Chacham by any stretch of the imagination. I don't know if he ever made a Siyam, maybe he did, I don't know, it could be he did. But he wasn't a big Talmud Chacham, he wasn't a big Talmud Chacham. You know, I don't know, that wasn't his... That it's important to know. That's part of the reason I'm saying it was, you know, he was a bright person, and he was firmer than all of us put together, right? But he was, it wasn't coming from great tornadoes. But when he would hear a Gadol speak, he would hammer home his message and speak about it all the time. So that was also something which very much appealed to him. And Agudas Yisrael, Young Israel, didn't have rabbis until the late 30s. That's a historical fact, which is very interesting. Okay, we're not speaking against Agudas Yisrael, but against Young Israel, just explaining why Mike had chose Aguda. What was his first large-scale project? It was a Shmir Shabbos campaign, right? Which they worked on every Thursday night for more than a year. He would stand at the street corner and speak about Shabbos and telling people only solicit Shomer Shabbos stores, right? The Lower East Side, New York is full of Jews, and there are many who are not keeping Shabbos. So this was their point. And he followed up, and here's where he first showed a tremendous organizational prowess. They split in a grassroots action system. You know, he split up the neighborhood, and some people took care of this block, some people took care of those blocks, and they, they signed people up. They signed up people, you'll only go to the Shomer Shabbos stores, and they went to the stores with those lists. Said, listen, we have 100 people on this list, 200 people on the list, 300 people on the list, who say they're only going to go to your store if you're going to be Shomer Shabbos. That obviously woke up store owners, and they were matzliach in closing down half the stores that had been Mechal Shabbos. Now they were, which is an unbelievable, and of course there was unbelievable accomplishment. They had protests. One time Rabbanim got water poured on them from two floors up. He harassed secular cantors. Yeah, his friend was Gedalia Shor. You guys know Gedalia Shor? Gedalia Shor was a tremendous gaon. He became the Roshiva of Torah Vadas, and he and Mike were best friends. Gedalia Shor wrote a sefer called Or Gedal Yal, which I'm sure you've heard quoted, or you will have heard quoted before the year is out. Otherwise, your money back. Okay. So they went into a certain shul and they would say, he sings in the morning in shul and afternoon in the Yiddish theater. Like they would give him a hard time. He was a knife. They called the police, got him out of there. And he was getting attention. Yeah.
So Mike Tess.
Tress.
Mike Tress.
Uh-huh.
Is he a rabbi?
No, he was not a rabbi. Mike Tress, that's what they called him. Mike. It's not like Rabbi Mike. Mike Tress, that was his name. Now, if you're like from, you call him Gabriel Elimelech, but they call him Mike. That's the name of the book. I always like to say, imagine how the Yiddish-speaking Rabbanim used to like to say Mike. You know, it must have been probably rolled off their lips with great joy and satisfaction. Mike. That's what they call Mike. I skipped over some stories about that, but you know, too time. Anyway, so, and he developed, I want you guys to see a picture of what it means. We talk about a word in Ishtar called movement. He was developing a movement. We'll see. That's exactly what he's trying to do. He developed Pirche, which really was a youth organization. Let's see what he says over here. His guiding insight from the very beginning was such that a movement would have to be centered around the youth. He wasn't just looking, this is something Rav Noach taught us, you don't just look at individual Jews all the time. Every Jew is a whole world, right? But you can accomplish so much more if you make a movement. It's a simple thing, right? He never stopped talking about the necessity of getting the youth, get the kids, and the dire consequences that would follow from doing so. If we get another five boys, they'll each bring in another five. You want to be a leader, you have to know how to get, we spoke about Meir Shapiro, how to touch the Jewish heart. But you have to know how to touch things in that. Depends what you want to do, right? But we don't think enough like that. Get five, they're going to bring in five. Get five girls, they're going to bring in five girls. That was the battle plan which he never wavered. So that's it. Now, what did he do? He wanted to show that you could be a Ben Torah and a man of the world. The lure of America was obviously you can be a man of the world. You can be American. That's what spoke to kids. But he wanted to show them that we could be Jewish and American and be involved in both things. And he did whatever it took. He played ping pong with the kids. He spoke to 10-year-olds. He sweeped the floor, banged their nails. He used to, when they would go bring pushkas for stucker boxes for Eretz Yisrael, he would go out with them. He gave a warm sense of Yiddishkeit. He used to sing with the boys. He used to dance with them. It's recounted here. His collar soaked. This is on his Simchas Torah. Gershon Kranzler remembers this. His collar soaked, a large handkerchief around his neck. One arm linked to the chaver, that's what they call himself, chaver, and behind him. Whether youngster, the second generation, or one of our elders with beard and black hat, all of them is chaver. Mike used to call everybody chaver. My friends, everybody was his friends. He pulled us along, roused us to the realm where the individual loses himself in devout inspiration. On the same theme, we're going to say, this isn't about him, this is about Rishraigo Feivelman Delovich, who also used singing and dancing in very much the same way in Tarvadas. They used to say that he built Tarvadas on a niggun called Al-Kainakava. You know that niggun? You have to learn that niggun. He built Tarvadas on the niggun Al-Kainakava. He said, one gadol saw him dancing at his wedding, listen to that, dancing at a wedding, and he said, that Jew did more with his dancing than all the Rosh Yeshiva with their Torah. That Jew did more with his dancing than all the Rosh Yeshiva. On Seder night, he would dance in his home for 3 or 4 hours. At Shalosh Shittos, they would sing, and he would sing at call at the Nagunim. Nobody rushed, nobody looked at the time. Okay, so anyway, that was about Shragul Feivelman Delovich, but it's the same point. He responded to the names of his time. He made a minion. Remember how we said he made a youth minion. Youth minyanim started a young Israel and a good Israel. They had youth magazines, entertainment shows. They played sports. Right? And those kids that he trained became the national leaders. That was the point. You know, each individual Jew on its own, but making a movement. Another telltale sign of how dedicated he was to youth was Camp Aguda. When I was younger, I remember there's something called Camp Aguda. I never went there. I never went to camp. You can see it on me, huh? But he saw that was something necessary, and he gave his he was a good businessman, but he gave away all his money. His last $25,000 of his stocks were pledged and lost as collateral for the present Agudas Yisrael campus. If you ever go to the campus in Agudas Yisrael, I wrote this 8 or 9 years ago, but because he knew this was a place where I could give them a great time and I could give them the correct Torah Hashkafa at the same time. They one time needed more svarim. Yisrael Belsky is one of the big Rosh Yeshivas in America today. He runs also the OU. I don't know if you guys have heard of him. Everybody knows Yisrael Belsky in America. He is the kashrus, in charge of the kashrus. He's not the director, but he's like a big rav. He's like the mashkiya. He's like the Rav Amatzir of the OU. Yisrael Belsky is a huge talmid chacham. So he says they needed svarim for the camp. Mike gave him a list of 20 names to call. Before he got out the door, Mike took the list back and he made all the calls himself. Then he writes to his cousin, who was Moshe Scherer, who took over for Aguda after him, who also has a book about him. I don't know as much about. He's also a great man. I love this, though. Our deficit, listen to this. Our deficit for the camp is mounting, and the financial headache is even greater than we thought. Things are bad. Then what did he continue? We can always find room for any worthwhile boy, regardless of the cost. You got it? That's leadership. It's getting worse and worse financially. We'll always take somebody in Gesher, even if he can't pay tuition. You heard it right here. Okay?
Well, to an extent.
The counselors were who's worthwhile, as I said. The counselors were possessed with a sense of mission. They received neither a salary nor tips, and every year the number of applicants exceeded the numbers of positions for counselors. Everybody wanted to be a counselor in a Camp Aguda because they knew this is the place. They carried their youthful idealism with them as grew older, and many went on to be the leaders within Aguda and in other klal activities. Okay? And besides that, they were, you know, on the stands at the time, they were very medactic. They davened three times a day, which was not everybody, not all, every Jewish camp did. They benched the whole thing. They learned twice a day. And they got to see the Gedolim. I remember I spoke to Nassim Geisler. If you know who he is, he has run seminaries here, and he's a fine person. So he told me that he remembers himself, as Erev Pesach, he told me, he and I both missed fasting. So the whole day I'm calling him up when he was making a siyum on Horus. I could only eat with a siyum, you know. So finally, like 3 p.m, we made a siyum. Finally got a piece of potato bill. Oh my gosh, I remember till today. Anyway, so he told me, I think in that context, or some other context, that he remembers watching Gedalia Shore and Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky playing chess together in Camp Aguda. And it was very interesting, we don't have time, but, you know, Gedalia Shore had like a razor-quick mind. And Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky was very oskechesh when he thought of all the possibilities of something, you know. So he said, Gedalia would like move fast, and Rabbi Yaakov would take the board in, you know, slow, and then make his methodical move, and then Gedalia would anyway. So I remember that. So this is what, and he took on individual products. Today, who doesn't know about Shatneys? Everybody's makbid on Shatneys. Well, 40, 50 years ago, no one was makbid on Shatneys, right? And there was a Jew named Joseph Rosenberger who was laughed at by people. He's going to come, and he's going to come and start telling people about Shatneys. And this is where the care of Shatneys today, and it's all in Joseph Rosenberg, who was a German Jew. It's all in his schus, and of course, who gave him office space? Mike Dress in the good of buildings, because he saw something like that. During the war, he developed the Jewish Servicemen Bureau, kept personal ties with the people, sending kosher food packages. G.I. Joseph. How does he feel? He finally, someone cares about him. He got a care package, right? And that after the war, he developed excellent books. We're talking about a good of Bechlal. Not every one of these things was Mike's exact project, but they developed books about Jewish, it was called Jewish Pocketbooks. Under the editorship of Joseph Elias, is pretty famous. He wrote, he made a new translation of 19 letters, and it was a more philosophical time. They wrote about Judaism, the individual, one second, the individual against the tzibur, capitalism and Marxism, science and Judaism, and these are just like excellent works which people still read today. I've never seen them, but you know, the way it's written about it, they were very fine books, and he raised tons of money. I'll take a question in a second. He raised money for Bata Yaakov, even though he had no daughter. His friend Gedalia Shore will mention again. He said he gave his first paycheck to open up the Beis Yaakov, help him the Beis Yaakov in what's called, it was Beis Sara. And he was always thinking, Mike was always thinking about Kiruv. He was always thinking about how to get another, more people. And he saw it then. Very few people saw it, but he saw that people were just going off. And get another five kids to camp, get another five kids to come to yeshiva. And then during the camp, of course, they would push the campers to try to come to yeshiva, come to Torah V'Das for Shabbos, and there was a whole network of Mike and his subordinates that were trying to makara all these people for themselves and for the movement for Klai Yisrael. Yeah. What? Elias or Elias? Now to say it? Elias, Joseph Elias, very famous Machanach, Joseph Elias, very famous. And what did all these projects together do? So besides the worth of each thing on its own, it gave strength to the fabric of the Jewish community back then. Right? We think about, when you think American Jewry today, you think about a lot of yeshivas, but it was all on the basis of what Mike and his people built. Let's see. I'll show you that. Whatever one could say about him, Sister Gedalia Shore said about him, whatever one could say about him would not be enough. He was responsible, listen to this, for bringing Torah to the shores of America. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said, because Mike Tress created a strong and good in America, when the Gedolim came from Europe, they had a base of Yiddishkeit from which to work. Without that, far less would have been accomplished. You see what I'm saying? He made like a groundwork. He put Torah back on the map. He made it interesting to be Jewish again with hundreds and thousands of people. And then there was things he couldn't provide, obviously, right? But then when the Gedolim came, they had someone who to speak to. There was someone there. Now, Yaakov Kamenetsky's message could get through. Aaron Cutler's message could come through. People wanted to go to yeshivas. People understood a little bit more what it was. Okay? He was together with Shraga Feinblum and the Lovitch and Rav Aaron Cutler, one of the principal architects of today's yeshiva world. His most enduring achievement is intangible, incapable of quantification, but you can't really give terms. It wasn't 20 people, it wasn't 30 people, it wasn't 100 people. But no less monumentous for all that. He gave a group of American-born youth, men and women, confidence in themselves. Confidence. Without confidence, what can you accomplish? And with confidence, you can do anything. And in their futures, Orthodox Jews. He called to them, Mila Shem Eli. Okay. He painted a bright picture of Orthodoxy in America and provided an environment in which young people could be happy in their Yiddishkeit without the feeling they were objects of ridicule. He gave strength to those who previously suffered from a sense of being left out. Mike gave us a sense, a woman said, that we don't have to be afraid of our shadows anymore. Okay? So this is a sense of what he did. I want to give you a little bit of a sense for a few minutes of what type of person he was. What were his attributes? What was his midos? So he is described as someone with a quiet dynamism. I like that terminology. A quiet dynamism. He was a dynamo, but it was a quiet dynamism. Like Rabbi Yael said. Seriously.
Not sure.
Okay? He had a tremendous way with kids. He would walk down the street, he'd talk to every kid he saw. He loved children. It says something about a person when he loves children, no? He talked to them about important meetings. He would go to Washington, we'll see in a moment. He used to go to Washington a lot during the war years, you can imagine, and he treated them seriously. He would talk to the kids. I went to the president, I was with Mrs. Roosevelt, I met Cordell Hull, I met the anti-Semite in the State Department. I don't know if he said that, but there were a lot of... He was creative. He was always thinking about new projects. He grasped situations quickly. He was decisive. He was unbelievably enthusiastic. And maybe most important, the Satmar Rav, who we discussed last week. Remember the Satmar Rav, he didn't join Aguda, right? And here was Mr. Arch Aguda. So what did the Satmar Rav have to say? He was a Tzaddik Tahor. And said, more than anything else, this is my personal look, he was sincere. You know, besides dynamism and charisma, those are all good things. If you're not a sincere guy, people see through you. And when people saw Mike Tress, they saw purity, you know? He was a master leader. He didn't have a bit of politics in him. You know what I mean? Not a bit of politics. Most people are leaders, even from people, it's hard to believe, right? They're in politics a while. They're leading an organization. You know, they know how to... You don't see... He had an unbelievable purity. A certain person says, when he spoke to me, it was like talking to my father. I wanted to be like him. Every person whom he came in contact developed a desire to be more like him. You want to be Mike. Everybody wanted to be Mike. Huh? They all wanted to be like Mike. The praise Tocha Kabor, his inside is like his outside, fully describes him. Everyone from the youngest child to the greatest Torah scholar experience him in virtually the same way. A heartsige mensch. You know what heartsige means? A man full of heart that one hears over and over. He possessed almost every quality for which a man is honored without the concomitant faults often associated with those qualities. He was a forceful leader, unshakable in his core beliefs, yet never angry or bitter at other people. I'm forceful. I'm a leader. I'm angry at everybody. He was dynamic, inspiring, yet soft and gentle. A man easily moved to tears, and from a harsh word was never heard. He knew he was a leader to whom others looked, and he accepted that responsibility, but he seemingly had no ego needs. He brought out the best in others and pushed them to the fore. He led a growing movement without ever losing sight of the individual. He was blessed with great charm and an easy manner with people, yet his moral seriousness was never in doubt. I should copy this paragraph for everybody. It's unbelievable. Look, you see him speaking now. You can see like a sincere guy, a Hamish Amench. He's got... He got the ideal human being. He was kind of the ideal human being. You know, Mayor Birnbaum, you know who that was? He was Nifta recently. So he said, oh, sorry. He had such a strength of character, and that was part of the way he was such a friend, and you couldn't say no to him. Mike wanted something. It was like it was you were putty in his hands. Mike wanted you to give some more money. Mike wanted you to go to the extra hour for Atzala. Mike wanted you to do the extra thing for the youth. You couldn't say no to him. You got it? You couldn't say no to him. You want to say no. And he believed in you. And he gave over the sincere belief in his people. You guys can do it. We can be the, and it wasn't Rameir Shapiro believing you, someone on high. It was one of them. It was their friend. It was their chaver. So my chaver could do it. You know, if Mike tells me I could do it, I could do it. Not because I believe in him like I believe in a rub. This is my man. You know, here that's what it was. Mayor Birnbaum, who was of Lieutenant Birnbaum fame. Anyway, he was a lieutenant in the army. He has a book about himself called Lieutenant Birnbaum. So he was shocked when he wasn't invited to his best friend's wedding. He's my best friend, Mike Tress. How can he not invite me to the wedding? But that's Mike was everybody's best friend. Huh? Okay. So, one point I want to add, which is really important. Together all this, he was a real family man. A lot of times people, great Jewish leaders, don't spend enough time with their wife, don't spend enough time with their children, and you can see the effect later on. Well, Elena, yeah, Mike was a big family man. His wife didn't get up on Shabbos. During the war years, we're going to speak about in a moment, he was busy the whole day saving Jewish lives. Got home 11 o'clock, the kids would run down to him, and the sense they had is that when Dad was home, he was home, right? A lot of nigunim in the house, a house full of simcha, full of joy. And an interesting thing, something to think about today, he didn't have a phone in this house for many years. You see, it makes it harder and harder with the phone ringing all the time and email access, etc., etc. And, you know, my mother calls them big phones. My mother lives in, like, the last generation. She calls them, like, she doesn't call them smartphones. She calls them big phones. I love that. She came back from America. She says, David, everybody's got big phones. Yeah, big phones. So you're always interrupted, right? So at the same time, he was getting home at 11 o'clock. At least when he was coming out at 11 o'clock for a while, the phone wasn't ringing. Something to think about, you know? I want to tell everybody, it's not usher to turn off your phone sometime. You're talking to your friend, no one is going to die if you're out of... You don't have to answer every email right away. No chiyuv. Yeah? And afuch, it hurts our humanness. Here's humanity. Mechanchot complained to my wife in America that they don't know... Girls don't know how to talk to each other anymore. Yeah? They don't know what it is. They don't know what relationships are. It's so strange. You have a relationship with, you have 1,000 friends, but not one. Facebook is called that way because that's all you see, the face. There's no depth to it. That's not my drasha, that was Dimash's. Okay, so we're going to talk about this. So with all these kolchos, he created real followers who are ready to work. There was someone who used to run food packages in 47, 48 to Jerusalem. Right, because if there wasn't food coming through, read O Jerusalem, a tremendous book. So he said like this. He said that years later, this was his comment. I never would have stayed involved for those years or afterwards at the Food of Jerusalem campaign, except for Mike. He was the center of everything. He was a spellbinder. He cast, but again, it was a sincere spell. You get it? It wasn't... He cast a spell over us and pushed us beyond what we thought we were capable of. Okay, we're going to skip that for now. Talk about how we're skipping what kind of salesman he was. Okay, not for now, okay? So I want to talk about his Hatzalah efforts during the war. Right? He was giving life to young fledgling organization right then. You know, I don't know exactly when. Here it says he took over in the 40s. I want to show everybody the picture first. Yeah. Right? So the war comes. Now, of course, you jump to save Jews. That was not it, of course. Listen, this shocks the mind. These are documented things. Don't believe me. Don't trust me about it. Look into yourself. There was something called the AJ Conference, American Jewish Conference, right? Where all major American Jewish organizations were represented. We're talking September 1943. September 1943, my friends, what are you talking about? I will be talking about how to get Jews out of Europe, how to save Jewish lives. I hope that's what you'll be talking about. Rebosa, what were they talking about? It wasn't even on the agenda. They were talking about the rights and status of Jews after the war. There's nothing to worry about now. We have to talk about what's our status, and of course about the state of Israel. Could you imagine? And even when it was in front of them to do something, they often pushed aside Hatzalah effort. This is true. I hate to say it, you know what I'm saying, but read the books. Yeah? Read the books. It's a very, very, very sad episode in our history, how little was done during World War II and the Holocaust that could have been done, right? Because they're all into their things, and God forbid you never did anything illegal, right? You could save Jewish lives, but if it's going to cross an American law, we're Americans, we're Americans. And this was a predominant attitude, I'm not saying by every individual, Bergson, there were people who were not like this, but this is the predominant attitude of established America, established Jewish organizations, established Jewish leaders, right? They put in two little efforts, and they would never do anything illegal, okay? Not Mike, right? First, I want to talk about his attitude. Already in late 1938, when he got involved in life-saving visa work, till there was scarcely a waking moment when he wasn't thinking about the people stuck in Europe. His whole mind was dominated. When he heard, there's a great guy named Menachem Zemba who died in the Warsaw Ghetto, he said he fainted. He pushed it, fainted. And he insisted that when there could, during the war years, there could be no normal life. Jews are dying. Life is not normal now, right? And what was the good of spearheaded by Mike doing then? They're working on getting visas. Right, because only through getting visas out could Jews get out. And included that was a huge amount of paperwork. Just it was like that. And sometimes he himself would be writing the visas on Shabbos, because if you had to get a visa ready with the 60 pages of all the stuff, you got to get it ready. Okay, obviously most of the time he wasn't ready. They were attending to the physical and spiritual needs of the refugees, getting houses and jobs, lobbying U.S. and other governments, food for Jews in Nazi lands, raising funds for rescue activities of others, the Sternbuchs and Weissmandel. Shabtai Frankel, why is that a famous name? Shabtai Frankel, anybody know that name? I'm going to tell you what he said, then I'll tell you why he's so famous, and my little shot at his famousness. To save people, he was a Vadatzala activist, okay? To save people, to help people, he worked day and night. He was never tired, he never said no. Mike never said no. One time I had an urgent meeting in Washington. I felt his presence was necessary. His wife was just back from the hospital with a new baby, but he said that he would go if his wife agreed and we could find some help for her. Mrs. Tress, of course, agreed. There was never a time when he pleaded that he was too busy to make an appeal or help in raising money. You asked Mike for help. You asked him to go to Washington. He was on the next train for you, no matter what. By the way, who's Shabtai Frankel? He made maybe the most impactful work in Jewish scholarship in the last 30 years, which is the Frankel Rambam. I'm pretty sure that's him, Shabtai Frankel. And you could say maybe it was the schus of being a Vadatzala activist that gave him such a schus. Those Rambams, which the whole yeshiva got rid of all the old ones, which was a mistake, but Shabtai Frankel Rambam is the Rambam which everybody has. It's like the standard. I remember when I was growing up, 23 years ago, yeah, I'm an old Chasha person now, right? But 23 years ago, like that was when it was just coming out, the Frankel Rambam. So I think it's the same one. Okay. Sympathy, sympathy won't help them, money would. The strain on him was tremendous. The strain of nonstop work and fundraising eventually took its toll on Mike. His friends worried about his health and the burden on his family. One of his friends said, "Are you degraded to the point of thinking of himself set for a change?" He said he had reached degradation, but he never thought about quitting. They were soon banished by the realization that if he ever thought about quitting when he would think about Jewish lives are at stake, he would never stop, right? A famous tzaddik, or Mordechai Schwab, you guys heard of Shimon Schwab? So Shimon Schwab, there were three Schwab, or four Schwab brothers. So Shimon Schwab was most famous, had a brother, Mordechai Schwab, was a tremendous tzaddik. When he came to the good offices, he came in, the first thing he did, he ran and he hugged and he kissed Mike. And he said, "The fact that we knew you were thinking about us, it gives people chizik, you know, the guy in the jail cell. At least there's somebody thinking about it." So the first thing he did when he got to America, he ran to the good offices, came and kissed and hugged Mike and his other people. And all he did the whole year was fundraising. He had many contacts in Washington, right? During the war years, he was constantly there, often by himself, sometimes with other lay leaders or Gedolim, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Avraham Kalmanovich. Right, he was there in Washington at the forefront. When told by the Secretary of State Cordell Hull, that was FDR's Secretary of State Cordell Hull, that Jews were being made into soap in Auschwitz, he broke down crying. And every time he would mention that subsequently, he would break down crying. He couldn't talk about that fact. Jews were being made into soap. Yeah, Henry Morgenthau, and remembers another one, Ravam Kemenovich, to get something done, he was wept. Mike was meeting with Spanish ambassadors late July 44 with the ambassador of the Dominican Republic to get passports. In October, he spent Shabbos Day in the White House with Morena Yaakov Rosenheim, another leader. right? He didn't get to see Roosevelt, but he did see who? Eleanor. Eleanor was a famous wife, kind of FDR. She and FDR didn't have a particularly close relationship. Whatever. But anyway, so at least he saw Eleanor. She was very famous, Eleanor. These are just a few isolated incidents. I just get to give a flavor. You know, it's a whole history of what went on during the war. But you get a flavor of something who was totally, totally dedicated to doing anything he could to save a Jew, which is how we should all be, really. You know, and you think about Kirov and the common parallels. You can draw your own conclusions. So we're going to finish with one other episode in 3-4 minutes. Maybe Mike's finest hour wasn't during the war, but it was after the war. It's very depressing to think about what a sad state the survivors were. No, the war is over, right? Now everything's good. Everything was not good. They were stuck in camps, and the camps themselves were terrible, right? We don't have time to go into it, but they were depressed. They didn't know where to go. People didn't want to let them in. Just think about the riches of the British, right? Not letting Jewish survivors, not letting many Jews into the war, sorry, but not letting many Jews into the war, into Israel during the war, and not letting them in after the war. Could you imagine? Could you imagine not letting Jews who had gone through the Holocaust into Israel because of the Arabs? It's mind-boggling. It is mind-boggling. He says a lot of GIs, I'm just quoting things that were said here, I'm not a bucket on this topic, but he says a lot of GIs were nicer to their Polish girlfriends than they were to the Jewish inmates, and sometimes they would give preference to Poles and not to the Jews. It was a sorry situation. They had nowhere to go. They were all depressed. Fine. So, of course, Mike continues with the types of efforts, finding places for the refugees, trying to get people out of Europe. But then he took a next step, which was to go himself, to be with the people, and to give them moral support. And just give me 2-3 minutes. We're going to discuss this. Yeah, he said he went. Other people came to see. You come in your nice little Jeep. You see the camps. You give them a blessing. Mike came. For those who felt let down not only by the world but by their fellow Jews, the love and concern Mike showed them changed their entire attitude for life. For those still unable to believe that tomorrow they would not be walking into a gas chamber, he gave hope where there had been none. Everywhere he went, he immediately impressed the refugees as completely different from the vast majority of those who came to the camps. Most came for a few hours, went away, and returned to home to write articles in the press, right? Oh, I was in the camp. You know, it's like when the rich people say, I went on a mission, you know? We went into a mission, you know? What does it mean? They're on this beautiful, beautiful plane, you know, first class, and then they have like an air-conditioned thing. They have no problem with them. And they put like a brick on a building in Zimbabwe, and they had a mission. You know, I'm nothing against it, but, you know, it's not exactly Mr. Snebbish. So listen, what they go right to praise. Not Mike. He immediately sent away his Jeep, canceled the hotel, and joined them in the camps, eating and sleeping with them his entire time in the camp. He came back, I think if I remember correctly, he came back without his socks. You understand? The man gave his socks away to the survivors. He radiated love and compassion to the survivors. He came carrying 200 letters and insisted on delivering each one personally. Everyone wanted to tell them their story, often over and over again, and they could see that he wanted to hear. He wanted to feel their pain. He spent hours at a time listening to the bitter memories of those who had survived. Everywhere he went, he carried with him a notebook, and he jotted down everything. He didn't just listen. He said, anything we can, he promised them, anything we can do, we will do, right? Getting visas. And after he left, people felt for the first time they could get out. In one emotional speech after another, he assured the sharers of plate to those left over from the Nazis that they were not alone and that the Jews in America cared deeply about them. That gave people life. Twice in his stay in Feldafing, one of the camps, he said he broke down. He didn't say, one of the people said it. One was on the 5th of Shvat, when the people danced on the Sfas Emes' yard site. That's where he's going to dance, the Rebbe's yard site, 235 Thursdays, guys. Yeah, and the second, when he visited Chai Sara, the girls' home, that he saw 100 girls, almost all orphans, benching. When he saw these Yiddish girls benching, he probably couldn't hold himself back, and he broke down crying, right? And he was totally seared by the experience. You know, he was, on the one hand, he says, we don't have time to go into it, but he was like, he says one time he visited one camp, and everybody was 16 to 25. So he says, we're the kinder, where the kinder? So they tell him, there are no children, you know. It was unbelievable. And he was a person, like we said before, he was so sensitive and so caring and so loving. It destroyed him. And some people say that this was like, you know, he never really got over fully the camps. That was the after the war. Some said that. You know, obviously he continued being a leader and things like that, but it went so deeply into him the whole experience. And he, of course, you know, implored American Jewry, a famous speech on February 10th, which is a very historic date. Why is February 10th a historic date? Because in 1969, who was born on February 10th? Me. Okay, that's a joke. That's true. It's just a joke. I mean, I was born on February 10th, but anyway, he gave a tremendous speech then, and he chilled all of American Jewry that were there with his tales and his push for further help. So Rav Ossai, of course, he continued afterwards, helped getting Jews out of Hungary, Morocco, etc. But I think we get an idea of who we can be. So again, when we think of we have to learn, when we talk about greatness, it makes us want to be great, right? And that's what we talk about, the other great leaders and the lessons, you know? But you have to ask yourself a question, you know, what did this guy have? Yeah, he definitely had something, right? He had a lot. But what did he have that we don't have? Why can't we be leaders like him? I'm not going to be a Meir Shapiro, you know? I don't think I'll be Mike Truss either, but, you know, he pulls you in a direction, you know? Why? There are the opportunities available. Jews need help. Chai Yisrael's in trouble. Kirov, we're just scratching the surface of saving Jews. Now, and you read about someone like that who had a simple message, you know, obviously had a lot of kochas, but he had a simple message. So it calls each one of us to say, you know, be a little bit more like Mike. Okay, that's Lacharabah.